Welcome to Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius, your source for horror, sci-fi, suspense, and all things violent.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Thank you so much for joining me today on Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius, episode 58. Today we have chapter 5 of Ain't No Messiah. That audiobook is still not out. ACX has been kind of delayed in approving shit, whatever, reviewing it. But that should be out pretty soon. But that makes this even more special because no one else has heard this yet. You guys are the first ones. This is the only place I'm sharing it. So hopefully you guys are enjoying the story. Today is chapter 5. If you haven't listened to the last ones, go back the last couple episodes and start from there. Very short episodes. I'm not talking a whole lot. I got a bunch of shit going on. So it's mainly a way to share this story that I'm hoping you guys are enjoying. On the writing front, things are pretty good. I am okay with not having much creative time. I am not getting a lot of my own stuff done. Beyond Brightside is super slow right now. I'm going through the final, well, not the final edits, but close to final edits. I'm trying to beef it up. It's only at like 62,000 words. Halfway, so the first half of the book is pretty solid. I just finished that up. I'm happy with that. We'll do some like line edits and everything. The second half of it definitely needs to be beefed up a little bit. And so that's what I'm working on right now. But I'm really just trying to get maybe a chapter a day. Meanwhile, the majority of my free time, because majority of my time is taken up with my son, playing a ton of board games and doing his schoolwork and hanging out with the family. But other than that, when I do have free time, I have been doing the Skype sessions with different people to develop Try Not to Dies. Last week I was talking about doing it with Steve Montgomery, working on Super High. That one is going pretty nice. He's working on it on his own. We'll meet this week to talk about it. He said he's already got scenes 1 through 10 pretty fleshed out. And so we will talk and prove the next couple scenes before he goes in on that. Another cool thing that happened, I would talk to my cousin Matt, who had always wanted to be a writer, just never thought he could do it. And so a while ago, we touched base over Christmas, talked about it. Slowly got the ideas going. He decided what he wanted to write, but then I hadn't heard from him in a while, and then he just sent me his first chapter, and it was really, really good. But I was telling him, we ended up doing a Zoom meeting, and I was able to tell him, like, hey man, this is awesome, but it's not what I want, because this whole chapter might get cut. I said, one of the things I've learned through writing is, fuck, don't spend that much time making anything perfect, because one, it's not going to be perfect anyhow. Two, there's a very good chance it's going to get cut or chopped up or whatever else. And like for example, for his, he was starting with the first chapter. He didn't know the rest of the book. He kind of had some rough ideas. And so what we did was, you know, he kind of told me what he was thinking. I was like, well, what I did with Steve, let's just put it into format. Let's break it down into roughly 22 chapters. And let's get the, you know, the start, the middle, and the end. Let's figure out what these big events are. And then I looked at what he'd given me and I realized, you know, the one chapter that he gave me was actually what I would do as the first 5 chapters, maybe even 6. And so now I gave him some directions like, okay, well, this is how I would see it. That doesn't mean it's necessarily right. But I was like, I would want one chapter, you know, seeing the place, and then another chapter seeing his mother and that interaction. Third one is him and this girl. Fourth one is this, you know, and then the action, the middle of the story doesn't start until he actually enters his day of trials. So that one's cool. So he's working on that. And now that I've given him that kind of talk, that getting him the ability to just give me stuff without it being perfect, that it's just simply, you know, we're sharing ideas. I'm not worried about anything being perfect at this point at all. That shit doesn't come till the end. So that one is in the works. I don't know how fast that one will come, because he is also working and he has a little, almost a 2-year-old and a baby on the way. So his might be slow. It might take a while to develop, but that's cool, because like Steve's going really fast on his. John Palisano, he'll be done with his, you know, shortly, his first one. I talked to my friend Brian about one. We might do one, about going to the grocery store. And that one would be just like pandemic, but further, and it would be really playing up this situation, making it worse. What happens if shit went really bad in the next 4 months? Something like that. I had already had that idea for a short story. I didn't write it. I've just been too busy with other things. But I realized, you know, it could be expanded for sure. So it could just be this person getting through the day, trying to get to the store and maybe somewhere else and back, with all kinds of crazy shit going on, like rioting or whatever else. So that one, again, that one, I don't know when that one would be done. I wouldn't be expecting that one done in the next 2 years or published in the next 2 years. But I did have an awesome conversation with my friend Sage Ricci. Him and Tom Spanbauer are my writing mentors. They're the people that really changed the way I look at writing with their Dangerous Writing program. He's also an awesome person. They both are. And so I talked to him about it before, but he was so busy with all these other things, going to school, and just life. But I wrote back to him the other day, and he said the timing was immaculate. You know, he's stuck at home. He's getting back into some of his old passions. And at first I was thinking maybe, you know, the Try Not to Die would be based off of coming out. Sage and Tom are homosexual. That's what they write about often. And I thought that'd be cool to have that as a topic. But when we were talking, he was talking about his passions and what he's done. And he's been playing Dungeons & Dragons, like, religiously since he was 11. He comes up with stories all the time. He says he come up with a story, like, just like that. Like, over, you know, someone come up with a question, and then he's got an entire story laid out. He has a lot of characters he's developed. So I think we're just going to go ahead and do a fantasy one with some of the characters he's created. It won't be Dungeons & Dragons, but it'll be set in that kind of universe. And on top of, I doubt it will just be one book. He'll probably do one of the characters, and then if people like it, we'll probably do another character, or he will just do an entire novel based off of those characters. So that's what I am suggesting to him. But yeah, so he's excited about it. The Try Not to Die in 25 Perfect Days, Olivia and I, my daughter and I, talked about that a bit. We were able to figure out where we want it kind of taking place and what the gist of it is. So I think now we know what's going to happen. We don't exactly know all the details, but it's starting to come out. And so I think this week we'll probably, what I'm going to suggest to her is we start drawing it on a map. We start making a map of the town that is going to open up a lot of stuff. We know there's going to be a church. We know there's, you know, we're going to figure out where their house is, what kind of houses these are, what kind of technology is going on. This is going to be showing 25 perfect days from the utopian side, but then the utopian side being invaded. So it should be pretty cool. I like the idea of, you know, 25 perfect days, most people probably realize or felt that the way you know, and the controllers were bad and were evil, and you get to see all the bad shit that they did because you're seeing it from the point of view of people that are experiencing it. This one is going to be from the point of view of a girl whose family has benefited from the way and the controllers, and they haven't seen any of the nastiness or the ugliness, especially as a teenager. So it'll be interesting to see how this girl takes, you know, these rebels coming in and trying to liberate them from something they don't want to be liberated from. So I think that should be fun. Again, that one's probably going to be a slower one, especially with the way things are right now. I don't have a lot of time to write. I know Liv isn't going to be able to write a lot. So especially while I got all this going on with all these other Try Not to Dies, that one will just be slowly built up. But again, that's awesome because I can't release that many books per year anyhow. Like, one is just the cost. Let's say each of these books, between the advance and copies and cover, audiobook, just all that, let's say it's about, let's say, 7 to 10,000 per book. So that may not sound like a lot of money, but if I'm trying to do three of those, and then I have to have more money for marketing and my other books and just all that shit, so that could be a lot of money and a lot of time. A lot of editing, a lot of really going over it to make sure everything is tight and just exactly how I want it. So I have to be careful with taken on too much. And how I have it now is like, okay, if you get your book in, you know, I'm just going to go, order of release will be order of it being finished. So if someone wants their book coming in at number 4, number 5, then they just need to speed up the writing process. So someone doesn't care and they're good with being number 12 or number 13, then that's cool too. My friend Anthony Johnson, a long time ago, we started on Trying to Die in Iraq, but he's been so busy with work and I've been busy, and so we just haven't touched it. But I was writing to him yesterday, and you know, I was like, on that one, I was like, okay, well, we'll get to that when the time's right. The time's not right for that one right now. And I have enough other stuff going on, so it is all good. And honestly, with that one, even if that one didn't ever materialize, I think it should, but even if it didn't, he already got such a benefit from it. Like, it pretty much knocked out his night terrors. I haven't talked to him recently to see if that's still the case, but it was the case for a long time. So that was a powerful type of therapy, by going over the stuff, by examining things that happened to him and writing about them in fiction. So no matter what happens, like, that was not a waste of time. And for sure, it wasn't a waste of time for me either, because I got to create with a friend and I enjoy it. So all these things, I get excited. When I got off the phone with Sage, I mean, I had goosebumps. I was thrilled. I was excited. I was like, this is awesome. This is what I enjoy doing. And I know with Sage, like, it's going to be a book. He'll probably be done in a couple months. And then that'll just be one more cool thing to add to this Try Not to Die universe. All right, yeah, I think that's about it. Not too much going on personal life besides board games and more board games and a little bit of video games and then some board games and then some schoolwork. Been trying to stay healthy. We got a hydro, a rowing machine, so I've been using that pretty consistently. I get high first because it's in the name, so there's that. But it's pretty cool. It's a good little workout. It's probably helping me with my posture, which has always sucked. So yeah, that's pretty much it. Doing that and continue to do the brain training at home. And that's about it. All right, guys, I want to get out of here. I need to get to my kids. I need to chop this up and put it out. I need to do a lot of stuff. I'm sure you do as well. But first, enjoy chapter 5 of the Ain't No Messiah audiobook. All right, guys, thanks for listening. Next week, it will be chapter, that's right, 6. All right, guys, have a good one. Talk to you later.
Chapter 5. It'd been about a year since we survived the tree. Father was furious at first with the hospital bills and all, but not once I recovered. That branch had somehow missed my heart, lungs, and everything important. The odds of me surviving were like 100-1. Father said I was undeniable. Once a month, he paraded me around town, shouting that I was the Messiah, letting people pay to touch my deep purple puncture wounds. The scars are pretty nasty, front and back, but I don't care because they're usually covered up. This day I couldn't bear to wear a shirt. It was so hot and muggy. It was almost like that branch had pierced my heart and the Almighty sent me in the wrong direction. Hell couldn't be much worse than our backyard, the air like quicksand, so hot the swamp could boil. And my job was to lug around a wheelbarrow full of boulders all the way from the front yard to the very back, over and over. All weekend long. When I turned the corner of the shed, Paul was right where I'd left him, lying on our 3-rock-tall wall, mother's old yellow towel beneath him, reading the Lost Gospels. Paul was only 7, but sounded just like Father when he got to reciting. I could break his body in half without even trying, but his voice had that boom, so different from the little sissy one Father had effectively slapped out of him. He also inherited Father's slippery tongue and wasn't afraid to use it. That was Paul's gift to share with the world. And ever since the tree, there was no doubt in Paul's brilliant young mind that Father was correct. He swore he'd praise my name until the day he died. I was breathing like a bull by the time I got to the wall. Paul didn't bother looking at me, so I didn't bother warning him. Just tipped over the whole load inches from his head. He shot up. "What the heck did you do that for?" I kicked one of the smaller rocks out of my way and took a seat on the wall facing the swamp. A beautiful orange and black spider the size of a snail wasn't but an inch from my shoe. Maybe I did it because I'm tired. You get the next load and I'll stack 'em. It's not my job. You heard what Father said. The spider made the wrong move and I squished it with my heel. Father says a lot of things. What's that supposed to mean? You're the smart one. You can figure it out. Tell me. I couldn't trust Paul to keep his mouth shut, so I said, never mind. I picked up a palm-sized rock and sidearmed it through the trees. A loud splash came through the darkness. He asked, you trying to stir up trouble? I picked up another rock and weighed it in my hand. What if I am? You want me to tell? You want to go in the swamp next? Paul got to his feet, the safer side of the wall. You wouldn't dare. I threw that rock as far as I could, heard it thunk off a tree and splash down. You're the one backing up. Paul would never admit to being frightened. He adopted his almighty voice and said, the devil's down there. The devil is everywhere. You just have to open your eyes. I found the biggest boulder I could lift and raised it over my head. Ever consider that I'm not scared of no devil? I started for the swamp, the dark, deadly place I'd never visited. I got the whole world in my hands, and all my hands have ever done is mess things up. The devil ain't gonna make things worse. Paul said, don't do it. I almost said okay because I was scared, but I needed to prove something to myself more than him. Something whipped through the woods off to the left, made me stop moving. Paul heard it too and whispered, don't be stupid. I veered toward the noise, pretending my destination all along had been the steel pole with the faded red flag marking the edge of our land. I dropped the boulder and felt the vibration of the thud all the way up to my knees. Loud enough for Paul to hear, I said, the wheelbarrow can't get any closer, and I know you can't carry them. Halfway back for another rock, I heard the laugh. It was a girl's, long, loud, and full of life. Paul said, where are you going? I pushed the thin trees to the side and continued past the marker, stepping off our property for the first time without Father. Didn't you hear that? You can't leave. I know the rules. But I didn't care and continued through the trees. The voice laughed again. It was a girl, and she sounded happy. Go, go, go! I walked a little faster. Paul hurried behind and whispered, Joshua, what are you doing? I didn't bother answering him. I walked out of the forest where two boys raced bikes on a dirt track. I'd only seen one other bike before, and that'd been when David brought his by after his birthday. He wobbled all the way down our driveway and sure didn't move like this. These boys were flying, whooping and hollering as they went over small jumps and banked past bushes. But it was the angel by the back of the mobile home cheering for Jeremy that had my attention. Even from 50 feet away, I could see she was beautiful. Dark brown hair hanging past her bare shoulders, a bright pink shirt, and tight blue jean shorts I'd never seen on a female. The racetrack was a circle, and the boys were headed toward me, neck and neck. The path was about 10 feet away, so I stayed where I was, watched their legs pump up and down. The bigger boy pulled out in front by a few feet, had an angry sneer on his face. The smaller guy, with the long hair, the same color as the girl, kept his eyes on the road, pedaling hard. They were just about to pass when Paul ran up beside me, wiping at his arms. The big guy with the short black hair and eyes sat back like a gorilla, glanced over and nearly crashed. The girl jumped up and down and shouted when the long-haired boy passed her. He jumped off his bike, raised his hands high. The bigger kid threw his bike down. No way, he said. That's bullshit. Jeremy said, it was fair and square, Frank. Frank pointed right at me. That queer bait distracted me. Everyone was staring. The girl waved. Jeremy said, you're the Messiah kid, right? Father said everyone knew or would one day, so I better hurry up and embrace it, and all I could do was nod. Frank yelled, go put on your shirt, faggot. I had no idea how to respond. I almost said sorry, but before I could, Paul took off running. There was no question where Paul was going, so I went after him, dodging trees, splashing through the muck, calling his name, begging him to stop. I made it to the rock wall as Paul hit the back porch, mud flying off his shoes. I yelled one last time, "Stop!" Paul threw open the door and disappeared inside, slamming it behind him. I just reached the bottom stair when Mother screamed, "What do you think you're doing?" It was strange to hear her yell at Paul, but that's what she was doing. Both her arms and hands pinning him still. She turned him around so you could see the mud splattered all across the kitchen. "What's gotten into you?" Paul's face was all screwed up into a jumbled mess. He was past hysterical, unable to cry, a low mewling worse than anything he could have said. "It's my fault," I said. "I'll clean it." Mother didn't question me, just pulled Paul close. "What Joshua do?" Paul couldn't lie to her, so I jumped in. "Nothing. I was teasing him. Sorry, Paul." She turned Paul so he faced her. "Is that true?" I backed up toward the door when Paul shook his head. Mother froze me with her stare. "What did you do?" "We were just working on the wall." "You stay right here," she turned to Paul. "What he do, honey?" Paul leaned close to her ear so I couldn't hear. Mother's eyes got huge. She shouted, "Charles!" I would have sworn time stopped if the clock hadn't kept ticking, the only sound in the world. My mother waited another second before yelling for Father again. Father shouted back, "I'm busy, you handle it!" In the loudest voice I'd heard her use with him, she said, "No, you deal with him. He's your son." Mother carried Paul to the back sink, not saying sorry when his shoe wiped mud all over my shoulder. With nothing but hate in her eyes, she said, "What are you waiting for?" Part of me was waiting for Father to walk over and set her straight. Tell her that wasn't how she talked to people, but he wasn't coming. I knocked on the office. None of us ever entered. He didn't bother opening the door, just told me to go to the basement. Don't be expecting any supper. Late that night, heavy footsteps thudded down the hallway. Dust floated down on me in the darkness. There was no question where he was headed. No time for me to do anything but sit there, hands on my knees. The door flew open and bounced off the wall. Father said, "Get your ass up here right now." I walked upstairs, but slower than usual, because if I was the Messiah, like he said, I should only have to listen to myself. Father had on his black jacket, the shoulder and elbows, the faded gray that dusted his hair. He shook his head and pointed to his room. "Get in there." I started to walk, thought how Father wasn't that much bigger than me anymore. His belly was growing from all the cookies he ate, but I was only about a head shorter. He screamed in my ear, "Right now!" I hated myself for hurrying into the only room that didn't smell like a bakery. The lights were off, the bedspread pulled tight, the fan blown cool air, and the smell of her gardenias. Father pointed at the wooden chair next to Mother's empty one. "Sit your ass down." I took my time. "Now! Or get out of this house." I wasn't even a teenager and knew nothing of the real world. I didn't have a choice. The TV took up the top of the dresser next to the window, filled with white flowers. Its wide black screen reflected an obedient little boy in a big body, my perfect posture sitting like he taught me. Father put a disc into the gray machine next to the TV. "I've made a huge mistake," he said. "I realize that now." He'd made so many. I wasn't about to guess to which he was referring. "What'd those boys call you today?" He already knew, so I went ahead and told him. "And what did you say?" "Nothing." "That's your response? Someone calls you a vile abomination, condemned to hell, and you say nothing?" "I'm not one." "That's better. But you didn't tell them that." Paul ran away and I chased after him. His eyes cast judgment before his mouth. "A coward." The other two seemed nice. "Seemed?" Father raised his voice, made like he was about to slap me. "You got to stop being so blind and see people for what they are. Stop being so damn naive." "I'm sorry." "How are you supposed to judge the living and the dead when everyone seems nice? People aren't nice. That's just what they show you. Look for the worst in them, and you'll find more than you ever wanted to see. Okay. Your brother won't always be there to watch over you. He'll help you on your path, but he can't make you do the right thing. You're old enough to know better by now. I know. I'm not so sure that you do. Father picked up his notebook and turned it so I could see his scribbles. You know what's in here? Your stories? They're your stories. They're the truth. I had yet to hear Father say anything that felt true, but I kept quiet. The things I write down in here are the things you'll tell the world. I know you have a hard time finding the right words sometimes, so that's where I come in. But you have to trust me. You have to believe me. Believe in yourself. I do. You don't sound like it. Father eased himself into Mother's chair. Even in the dim light, I could see the gray fanning out from his temples. In profile, Father appeared defeated and dejected. After a long pause, I asked, "How do you know it's true?" "Some things you just know. Just like I know what you are, even if you don't. It doesn't stop my faith one little bit. You are the Messiah. You'll save the world." "Okay." Father leaned back, ran his hands through his thinning hair, and turned on his church voice. "You have no idea what these non-believers will do. They're demons wanting to sabotage you. They laugh at your church, at me being your mother's errand boy, a goddamn delivery man." He wasn't about to stop, so I stayed quiet. "Look for the worst in people, for that's how you shall judge them. Anyone can be nice for a day, a minute, a moment. It's what they try to hide. The things they know are wrong, but they do them anyway. That's how to judge." I nodded. I looked at him like he always told me to. "It's a fine line. You must walk among your fellow man, yet you must always remain above them. Be the example for them all to see, the beauty they desire, the strength they need." When I didn't respond right away, Father said, "Are you even listening?" "Yes, sir." He spread his arms. "All of this, all my work, it's for nothing if you don't take your place and start acting like it. We're down to 7 families, Joshua. That doesn't even pay for the electricity. But that's fine. I'll keep driving around the country trying to spread the word so you can ruin it by sneaking off and throwing this all away. You think I want to be yelling at you, having this conversation?" I wasn't so sure, but I said no anyway. His contemptuous gaze was on my hands, as if I sickened him so much he couldn't stand to look me in the eyes. "I've tried to protect you and your feelings." He walked to the TV and punched a button. The screen lit up and was suddenly filled with the image of a man and a woman, tangled together, sheets barely covering them. I hadn't seen television since my last stay at the hospital, and even then I only got a few minutes before Father spoke to the nurses and had the box of temptation taken from my room. It amazed me, witnessing such lifelike drama coming from such a small screen. "I warned your mother not to baby you. I worried you wouldn't be able to handle the real world. You wouldn't be able to deal with what you saw." Father's voice ramped up with every sentence. "But I can't do that anymore. You think that you're a man? You watch this. You watch and see what you're doing. Your sins, your refusal to be the Messiah. Now follow the rules. Look at the evil you're sanctioning. See the world we live in thanks to you." I wanted to say that was all I ever wanted, especially if it was like the place I'd imagined, where people could do whatever they pleased if it didn't hurt anyone else. But all I did was look at him and keep my mouth shut. I'm not sure how long she'd been there, but Mother was in the doorway, yellow dish rag in her hands. She said, "Charles, I don't think..." Father silenced her with one finger. "I know what you think." Mother shook her head and walked away the first time in so long I didn't want her to. "Pay attention," Father said. He hit a button on the machine and dialed up the volume. "Tell me you think you're setting a good example. You're showing people how to live." The screen flashed to another scene, a beautiful morning. Blue skies, white clouds, buildings so high they didn't look real. Is this a movie? Father backed up to the bed. Watch it. How could I not? It was incredible. It's what I've been missing my whole life, a glimpse of the real world, an escape from mine. A collage of images passed by, one after another. The city so huge, 100 times Hartsville. The smallest buildings were 10 times the size of anything I'd ever seen. But it was the two massive ones I was stuck on, the way they stretched past the clouds and into the heavens, a testament to what man could achieve. This went on for a minute, showing me a world so much bigger than I could have imagined. The image got shaky. Screams as black smoke gushed out of the hole ripped through the top of the first structure. An airplane headed for the second tower. I started to point, but it was too late. The plane hit where I couldn't see, a gigantic fireball blowing out the other side. Were there people in there? What do you think? The angles were changing, zooming in and out, the fire, the smoke, people hanging out windows, people leaping from the flames, a couple holding hands. The animals that did this, Father said, wiping his forehead and clearing his throat. The cowards behind this, they don't believe in you. One of the towers collapsed straight down in an explosion of gray dust. Bloodied bodies being carried away, people running, crying, everyone gray. Who decided who lived and who died? I hadn't chosen. There they are, Father pointed to the 19 dark faces on the TV, most of them bearded. The heathens responsible for so much death, men who say you're not real. The screen was back to carnage. Twisted metal, covered bodies, faces of the victims. Your actions do have consequences for others. Father's throat caught and he had to clear it. Think about this the next time you sin. Think about what you're doing, what you're condoning. A tear rolled down Father's cheek, the first scene since Paul. It only made him madder. Damn all non-believers to hell. Have no mercy on their souls. Pray for the innocent people that died. Father grabbed my head and forced it back to the TV. It was a big white building with five sides, one of which was blown to hell from some sort of explosion. Do something for once. Make this world a better place. Father stomped away, slammed the door behind him. Do something.